When Kirsty interrupted me, I was in the break room. I just sat down at the round, perpetually stained plastic table in the corner and was listening with satisfaction to the coffee maker as it began its quiet gurgle. Reluctantly, I made a small gesture of greeting. She asked if it was a fresh pot, and I nodded. And to discourage any further conversation, I bent my head over the weekly paper that happened to be open on the table in front of me. She was dressed, I noticed, entirely in athletic clothing. She passed behind me and added, startling me, "Is that the horoscopes?" She moved closer to me, and I could smell the scent of her freshly exercised body in the small, windowless room. "That's funny," she said. She had not pegged me for the kind of man, the kind of guy, who read the horoscopes. "Oh," I said quickly, I'm not reading this." And as I said it, I saw that I looked like a very poor liar. I had failed to notice somehow that the paper in front of me had been turned to the horoscope section. And not only that, but the facing page had been folded back with care. It was all very odd. The horoscopes had turned out to be something very different than I'd expected there to be. "Uniquely positioned," mine read, "to set things in motion." As much as I lacked confidence in the source, the message could not reasonably be dismissed. It was not irrelevant at all. Could it be a coincidence, I wondered, that I had received this strange message on this day, the day of my father's open house? A strange message, undoubtedly. And yet, somehow, encouraging. That's from the opening chapter of The Scapegoat, a novel by Sarah Davis. The Scapegoat features and is told by a man who lives and works in a nameless college town, who becomes haunted by memories of his recently deceased father, a man our narrator realizes he never really knew. A series of unexpected circumstances over the course of just a few days deepens the intrigue and pulls our narrator ever more down the rabbit hole he's chosen to follow. His deceased father's house going up for sale. And then his finding what he interprets as a cryptic message. In reality, it's most likely just a note his dad made at one time. On a piece of hotel letterhead our narrator finds tucked away in a suit pocket in his dad's bedroom closet. He's visiting, somewhat surreptitiously, while on the spur-of-the-moment tour of his father's now-on-sale open house. Then there are the peculiar circumstances that arrive that very same day of the surreptitious house visit. His horoscope that day, as we heard at that opening, and he never reads his horoscope, had urged him to put things into motion. When our narrator finds himself invited to the room of a visiting scholar later that day in the very hotel on whose letterhead his father's note was written, his mind is reminded of that horoscope's urging. And very soon after, our narrator remembers finding himself the subject of stares and whispers by folks who work on the same office floor, and then again while attending a lunchtime concert on the campus in which he works. And our narrator begins to weave all of these happenstances into a skein of suppositions that focus on the maybes of the hows and whys of his father's unexpected death, ignoring the likelihood that all of them are not but the everyday odd happenings in life that can and do happen in all of our daily lives. Well, as the pages turn and the chapters move forward, the novel takes us deeper and deeper into the bizarre, as our narrator slowly loses touch with reality. He spins for himself, and therefore for us, a tale in which he is convinced his immediate goal in life needs to be, must be, setting into motion his quest of finding the truth behind his father's death. After all, he tells himself, why else would the guest lecturer I mentioned earlier invite him to her room for a drink after their dinner? An invitation that takes him into the very hotel in which his father's cryptic message was written. Adding to the narrator's confusion and unease, he finds the hotel is staffed unfailingly at each of his visits, for he finds himself visiting the hotel quite often now, by a prim but friendly young man with flawless skin, as he tells us. This young man greets our narrator from his post at the front desk, which looks out on an ultra-modern lobby, underpopulated, with an underused bar and sleek, almost inhuman furniture. A hotel, our narrator tells us, that exudes an atmosphere that is dim and quiet and just a bit menacing. The off-kilter feel is integrated further as he describes his everyday work life as a glorified secretary, a description given him by one of the medical staff's stuffy doctors. He does so with an odd relish, sharing with us descriptions, as you heard, of that dumpy staff room with its burbling coffee maker. He is a real coffee drinker. And his office window that looks out from its second floor perch onto a parking lot, a view which gives him more than one chance encounter with campus folks who, he convinces himself, if not us, are quietly teasing him with hints about his father's unexpected demise. And to complete this increasingly eerie daily circle of life, our narrator invites us into his home, built near an unnamed ocean, where he makes open-faced salmon sandwiches after work and watches the morning fog as its long white fingers seep into the piney landscape in which his home is nestled. It's all just a little off, we come to discover, this life of everyday sameness that contrasts baldly with our narrator's newfound passion. Spoiler alert, the bloody climax of our story is not what happens in the very last chapter, as a reader is justified in expecting, but rather the overwhelming, if inevitable, rendering of fear and anxiety that comes just a little bit earlier in the book. The final chapter is not but a much-expected denouement, as our narrator falls fully out of reality, leaving a chillingly bloody ending in his wake. When I first began reading The Scapegoat, through several of the first chapters, actually, I was reminded of the many popular Gothic novels so popular back in the 1970s, novels by Phyllis Whitney, by Victoria Holt, novels set in seaside mansions or upscale townhouses, featuring eerie goings-on that our protagonist only discovers through chance, and usually with a romantic encounter hinted at and usually taken up much further as our story deepens. Which is not to say this is a throwback to the 1970s. Far from it, as we discover reading through to the end. Though weirdly, this very title, The Scapegoat, was used by Gothic high priestess Daphne du Maurier for one of her novels written back in the day. All in all, today's novel has a very contemporary feel and setting, and a contemporary set of characters and characteristics. The Scapegoat ends, then, not with a young heroine unraveling a mystery of intrigue laced with romance, but with the sudden realization that we, the reader, have been had by a very crafty and talented storyteller whose narrator has taken us along for a ride back in time. In the end, it is difficult to know for sure if the narrator's story is meant to be read as a series of haunting memories or the murmurings of a sadly out-of-touch mind. Yes, it's a quirky, odd novel, is The Scapegoat. Not a novel I would usually read, much less enjoy, but I found myself doing both. Reading it, it's addictive, and enjoying it as I went along. And I invite you to give the book a whirl yourself. Let me know the spell this weirdly addictive story casts on you. The Scapegoat, a novel by Sarah Davis, set somewhere in an unnamed college town near an ocean. It's quite a read, quite a haunting read. And it's available at all of our fine local public libraries, including, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library. Thank you for listening.